This is an ABC podcast.
Hi there, this is The Minefield, coming to you once more in the midst of this pandemic. It's going to be like that for a little while, I fear. It's a program where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. We are being thrown dilemmas, questions, the like of which we've never seen. Waleed Ali is my name, Scott Stevens is my co-host, and Scott, we begin, I think, with the usual declaration that we don't know when we're talking to you, really. This, of course, is pre-recorded because of the situation that we're in, availability of studios, and that's kind of where we sit at the moment. So please bear that in mind when you listen to us. There might be things we say that are out of date. There might be things that are tonally a bit jarring as the tone changes in ways that we can't foresee with a rapidity that is, frankly, mind-boggling. But nonetheless, here we are, and we'll do our best. How are you?
I'm all right. This is strange. You know, there's something unusual. There's something unique about what's going on. There's also something, I don't want to be trivial about this. There's also something kind of universal about it. I mean, it kind of feels to me not so much that we are simply living through moments of unusual precariousness and scarcity, but that maybe the curtain to some extent has been pulled back, and there's something about the way in which reality really is and the way in which our lives really are that we're being confronted with in the most unusual circumstances. In other words, this isn't just unique. There's also a degree of a kind of wake-up call about this, a shattering of our illusions that I think is, okay, it's not pleasant, but I think it's morally instructive.
Mm. This is almost like a great reckoning, isn't it? Mm. We are, in so many ways, having the reality of our lives and the way we have lived reflected back at us. And to raise an example that we're not going to go into, because that requires far more expertise than either of us have and would be a whole other show, although it would be a worthwhile one if we could somehow pull it off.
Yeah.
Economically, you know, I had this conversation with a friend of mine who's a political scientist, so neither of us know enough about economics to answer this question. But I was sitting there going, well, now everyone's financially struggling, or not everyone, but a lot of people. But the money of the world doesn't disappear. So who's going to have it? Like, if no one has money, someone must have lots, right? Mm. So this is really a crisis of money circulating. It shouldn't be a crisis of money disappearing. And then we got to the point, well, actually, no, it probably is a crisis of money disappearing because so much of the money that keeps our economic system afloat isn't real. It's fake money. It's debt-based. It's asset values that are inflated that then suddenly crash. And so the money does disappear. And that's a pretty extraordinary reality to be confronted with. Like, when that's made clear to you, it's something that lots of people have known, that when it's made clear to you, it becomes real in a way that it previously hasn't. The unsustainability of that whole model, the interdependencies that we've been speaking about a lot over the past few weeks on this show become really clear. But the one thing that I want to...
Sorry, Willie, just before you move on, though, there is one thing, though, that's, I think, worth dropping into that particular pond, and maybe we should do a future show about this. I read a book last year by Oliver Bullough that scared the pants off me. It's called Moneyland, and it's about, from memory, the third or the fourth largest economy in the world, which is that shady network of offshore funds, offshore bank accounts, on which there is no tax, that aren't part of, let's call it, the social economy. I mean, if you go so far as to say that the great lesson of the Second World War was that a society that deals well with taxation, that collects tax and that redistributes and uses tax justly, is one of the markers of an ethical society, then the very fact that there is that much money that, quote-unquote, exists, and I take all of your provisos there, I think that's right, but the fact that there is that money that has been willfully ripped out of the global system that could do so very much for the world now, I mean, this is a form of systemic immorality that is almost backbreaking, I think.
Well, there you go. You've introduced a future show. But yeah. I'm going to...
What did you want to talk about?
Well, the big reality that we've been confronted with, and it's probably the one that I think we find most difficult to deal with. Certainly, that's true in the initial, like the early phase of the pandemic, because we go through all of the various cycles of mourning and of grievance, which is kind of what's happening, right? And there was the denial phase, the anger phase, all of that. The big reality we're being confronted with is that of a lack of control, a lack of certainty. We are really being told in no uncertain terms that the world that we thought was more or less under our control isn't. It's in charge of us, really. We are at its mercy. And at some point when all these things converge to push a button that says that nothing we have been doing we can any longer do, we freak out because this is counter to the reality that we'd built. We'd built this false mirage of the way that life works, and now the falsity of that mirage, of that image, has become really, really clear. And I think that's probably one of the most morally instructive aspects of all of this. Wouldn't you agree? That
yeah.
We have to confront that reality. The inherent arrogance that human beings carry around, I'm not exempting myself, by the way, from any of this. The inherent arrogance that we carry around is really being crushed. we're being put in our place. And I wonder what the moral consequences of that become on the other side. How do we really come to terms with the innate vulnerability, lack of control, uncertainty that has always been there, lurking beneath the surface of human life, but which we've kind of papered over and painted over in the most spectacular way?
I think spectacular is exactly the right word for it. So if you just sort of unravel things for just a moment, I think one of the really remarkable things about this is that, I mean, this is a reminder that the world doesn't revolve around us. And as soon as you acknowledge that, I mean, first of all, you know, there's a great, wonderful strain of moral philosophy, of theology even, that is about precisely this great human delusion, kind of the self-idolicization of human beings. And then you've got these glorious moments in the work of, say, Immanuel Kant or Simone Weil, where things exist and they have nothing to do with you, and your responsibility is to bow your knee to them, effectively. There's something about that that I think that is chastening. It's terrible. It's morally compelling. But then you realize, Willie, as soon as you acknowledge that, my God, the number of alibis that we have constructed, the myths that we've bought into and based entire civilizations on, that are predicated on the centrality of our will and the unquestionable nature of our control. Even if we just go back so far as, say, Adam Smith and his employment of the overtly providential language or image of the invisible hand, that the chaos of the market works to our benefit. Eventually, everything will settle in our gravitational orbit. Then you think about the fact that for the last 70 years, we have been living in a position of willful precarity, where under the guise or under the rubrics of efficiency and profitability, we are living in terms of our public health system, in terms of our social welfare systems, with just enough, maybe even too little, but on the very best reading, just enough. Because you don't want to have excess capacity in a system, because excess capacity is, by its definition, unprofitable, right?
So until you really need it.
Until you really
need it. Yeah.
And then you realize, hang on, we could have been preparing for this if we acknowledged the essential nature of human vulnerability and uncertainty. If we just acknowledged that from the outset, then we would have been able to build in those rituals, those forms of policy that take the fact of our position in the world seriously. And then finally, I'd say, Waleed, that the sheer hubris with which we approach things like climate change, this again is part of the self-same delusion, that eventually everything will settle in to the orbit around us. All things will bend their knee to the centrality of human will. I mean, it's always been morally repugnant. It is now just farcical.
Yeah, so I think everything you said is right. But here's one rider I want to put on that. Even what you're talking about there, let's assume we'd created systems that were not so obsessed with efficiency and running at the margins, really everything being lean, but we were allowing systems that had the capacity to absorb these sort of shocks, right? Because we understand that we're vulnerable in ways that we have hitherto not been prepared to admit. All that still, to me, is an attempt to try to preserve
That's true.
And reestablish control.
That's absolutely
what,
right.
What you're kind of saying is we should have built a system that would have allowed us to remain in control. Isn't that what you're saying?
I wasn't thinking it at the time, but
I'm not saying you're wrong that, you know, there were other ways of creating these systems, but I'm saying that any way you cut it, the big moral reckoning, perhaps even psychological reckoning, has got to be a comfort with the lack of control, an understanding that you do everything that you possibly can, but at the end of all of that, what will happen, right? There are ways in which you can better prepare and all of those sorts of things, but you're never invulnerable. There's no, it's one thing to critique the systems that we've built. It's another to persist with a myth that if only we'd created better systems, then we would be invulnerable. So at some point we have to reckon with that irreducible vulnerability, do we not?
Existential vulnerability.
Yeah.
Look, Waleed, I think that's right. I mean, I'm assuming that it's the nature of public policy to try to bend towards and strive towards stability, and that willfully inflicting damage or being caught in a state of unpreparedness in order to teach societies valuable lessons about ontological humility. That, I suppose, was the immediate background. And I know I'm saying that in a way that's deliberately kind of cheeky. I guess I'm just saying that even public policy can reckon with vulnerability. How much more so do we as moral agents? So we were just talking about, if you like, the background conditions of our illusions about invulnerability. In other words, the fact that we kind of believe that there's this almost this secular providential design that bends everything towards us. I should say that there's another way in which vulnerability is denied, and that's in the post hoc explanations and forms of blame, the recriminations that we engage in. I saw something the other day that shocked me that just I didn't think it could, and that was some enterprising photographer for the Washington Post zoomed in on the notes that Donald Trump was speaking from during a press conference about coronavirus. And with a big black marker, he scrubbed out Corona and wrote above it Chinese. It took my breath away. I mean, you can say sometimes politicians saying things, they're simply intending to be descriptive and maybe shorthand, and that come across as being xenophobic and racist. And then you have that kind of willfulness that is a way of saying, we are not to blame. Somebody else is to blame. They have a face. They have a race. It terrifies me. It chills me. And it worries me that for exactly the same reasons that we indulge so willfully in forms of providential explanations, you know, everything is meaningful and it's meaningful for us, that process of post hoc blaming is, I mean, God help us.
I agree, with the exception of I don't share your critique of providential explanations.
I didn't think you did.
Yeah. I think actually that's the most important task, isn't it, right now, is to derive meaning from these things, because it's from that that lessons can emerge. That's the way it works. The problem with describing it as a Chinese virus, apart from the obvious racist overtones to that, is that it reestablishes this idea that it could have been controlled.
Yeah,
that we are in control. If only people were more like us, we'd be in control. I think the fundamental task is deriving meaning from the loss of control. What does that tell us about our existence as human beings? Anyway, I can sense your urge to respond.
I'll just say, as a theist, okay, let's be blunt. We've never done a show like this. It's incredible.
No, of course
we are both theists, let's just say.
Yeah.
And I fundamentally disagree about the, I don't want to say rush to meaning, but even the way in which meaning can happen afterwards. And thankfully, that's exactly what we're talking about.
All right. Well, we have a guest to try to help us. This is The Mindfield. You can listen to the show on RN. You might be doing that right now, but we also exist as a podcast, and you can listen to us on the ABC Listen app anytime. This podcast, if you subscribe, you'll find we have extra content at the end of the show. So please do subscribe if you'd like to hear that. But now, someone who knows more about all of this than both of us.
Look, I'll just say before I introduce our guest, a little apology. We went on a little bit longer than we usually do because we were having a number of technical issues with bringing our guest onto the show. We've never really done a theological episode of The Mindfield before, but we're doing one now, which is why it's great that we've got David Neuheiser as our guest for today. He's research fellow in philosophy and the study of religion at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at Australian Catholic University. He's the author of a fabulous new book called Hope in a Secular Age. David, thanks for pressing through the technological problems and joining us on The Mindfield.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Waleed. I'm glad we got there.
So let's try to separate these two things out. There is, on the one hand, a kind of illusion that God has made everything for our benefit, and therefore everything will work well for human beings at the center of reality. And then there's the point that Waleed brought up, which is, through moments of crisis, we have these genuine moments of existential or ontological vulnerability. The important task then is to try to find meaning in the middle of that. Do you see those two things as being implicated with one another? Is one more morally and theologically worthy than the other? Where do you want to take us?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is that I'm a specialist in the history of Christian thought and contemporary continental philosophy, and those traditions are enormously diverse, so I don't think Christian tradition speaks with one voice on this. But the sources that I'm most interested in are really modest about their claims on behalf of knowledge of God. So in terms of knowledge of God's intentions, the tradition of negative theology, which I've looked on a lot, emphasizes that we can't comprehend the divine. And so claims about how creation is organized, claims about natural law, this tradition tends to be fairly cautious about claims like that. And to emphasize that actually creation, in their view, is a miracle and it's a mystery. And so they do believe that it comes from God, but it has a sort of mysterious character that underlines rather than mitigates our vulnerability. So the idea that everything comes from God and is a gift, in a way, rather than providing answers, rather than providing a sort of existential sense of security. For this tradition, it actually teaches us that human life is radically contingent.
So, David, let me just, though, tap into the other area of your expertise, because we're not, after all, just talking about abstract theological questions. As soon as you say that the world has a form of divine meaning, and I know what it is, there are certain forms of individual and collective action that then proceed from that. So to say that I know the theological DNA of the universe, I know what's good, I know what's evil, I know who's on which side, that's also then the basis of certain political claims. And so a big part of your work has been the importance of the unknowability of divine will for political organization.
That's right, yeah. So there certainly is a form of political theology where theology becomes a source of authority that's claimed for particular political movements, such that some people claim, as you suggested, that they know what the meaning of the world is, they know what God's will is, and that sort of gives their political program divine warrant or authority. The tradition that I am most interested in is quite skeptical about claims of that kind, to know the divine will. I still think this tradition is deeply political, but I think of it as a kind of negative political theology. So I think what it teaches is less the sort of assertion of authority. It doesn't give answers to questions, but I think it models a sort of ethical disposition towards political problems that holds together the need for self-critique and the importance of acknowledging the limits of our knowledge, the impossibility of control, without relinquishing the need for decisive action when circumstances require it. So it sort of holds together affirmation and negativity in a way that I think is broadly important, but especially in a crisis such as the one we're facing now.
So, Scott, I'm trying to figure out whether it's helpful for us to be approaching this as a theological matter or not. So when we talk about meaning being derived from these things, I think that's a question that arises irrespective of one's religious commitments, to some extent. I mean, I get there are, you know, schools of meaninglessness, kind of ontological nihilism, if you want to think of it that way. I get that. And my own disposition is that that doesn't have much to offer us. But if that's what you hold on to, then that's more or less the end of the discussion, right? There is no meaning to anything. So why should we search for meaning in the midst of a crisis? But I think there is a very important distinction, which is kind of being drawn out here, which can apply whether you are a theist or not. You can believe that there is meaning to be derived from things without necessarily saying, I can identify for you a single universal meaning that applies to everybody in every situation, right? The thing about a catastrophe is, and we've already seen this, we've seen a range of social experiences and social meanings that have emerged out of this already, right? Things to do with solidarity, as we discussed on the show last week, or, you know, things to do with political formation, things to do with economic formation, all of these sorts of things. We discussed a couple of weeks ago the idea of forms of living and how this shines a light on those sorts of things. What forms of living will we be forced to go through now that might emerge at the other end that we might hang on to because we discover how valuable they are? Even if the meaning of this is that we confront our own vulnerability, that's still the meaning that is attached to that. You don't need to have some kind of claim to an absolute universal meaning that is the same for everybody in every situation. The thing about a pandemic like this is the sheer multiplicity of meanings. But that's not to say that the search for meaning or the idea that there is meaningful stuff to be drawn from this is a fruitless search or a pointless search or even a bad one, right? I think the idea of trying to reassert control, by which I don't mean doing our best to try to control the effect of the pandemic through social distancing or whatever, that's clearly relevant, good, important stuff. Mm. But what I mean is, I think the idea to try to hang on to an ontology of control, that we are in charge of everything, I think that's a bad move. But that doesn't mean that the search for meaning or ontological meaning or whatever is a bad move, irrespective of one's religious beliefs.
No, look, I think you're right. I do think that the theological language here is probably more helpful rather than less, because it does highlight the extent to which even many of our avowedly secular understandings of the world still have some surprising residual theological components to them. It strikes me that the kind of vapid political optimism that we are hearing from certain political leaders at this time, whether it be under the rubric of we need to reopen the market and the market will sort of eventually make everything better, or everything's going to be fine, these are forms, if you like, of a kind of secular teleology that all of these seemingly disparate elements are working together towards some common end that's going to be really, really good for us. After all, I guess it's that I find more dubious than anything else. To what extent, for instance, is meaning something that we imaginatively come up with through the radical experience of radical limits? To what extent can we reach at this moment for a kind of non-teleological meaning? And by that I mean a meaning that didn't predate the meaning that we come up with, meaning that we discover through the very flux and chaos of things. But I think here there's a form even of, I don't know what David's going to think about this, maybe we'll have to pick it up in the podcast, but there's also this great tradition of what I think we can call Jewish negative theology, where the divine, God's own self, is caught up with, is implicated in the chaos and indeterminacy and flux of the world, and that part of our struggle to try to discover forms of meaning and justifiable ways of living is a process that God's own self is caught up with. It's a form of kind of radical moral reasoning that is, I think, best reflected in something like the Book of Job. So I think the struggle for meaning here, it's not unrelated to theological questions. The question is God so much on our side that God's going to make sure that everything comes good for us in the end? That, I think, is the quasi-theological language that's coming through so many of the political pronouncements we're hearing at the moment.
All right. So, David, last word to you before we get to the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I really resonate with the question that you're raising, Waleed. And that's the reason why I see this tradition of negative theology as being fundamentally concerned with hope. Because this modesty, the sort of self-critical negativity that it exhibits, in my understanding, doesn't shut down the search for meaning, but it opens it up. It means that the desire to create meaning, to try to do the best we can under challenging circumstances, is radically contingent. And I think it articulates a really powerful form of hope that enables us to acknowledge our vulnerability, acknowledge our lack of control, but to press forward and do the best we can under those circumstances. And that's the thing I think, as you were suggesting, we really need at the moment.
David, thank you. Hang around, though. We know that we struggled to get to you because of the technology, so we want to wring more from your brain if possible. So we're out of time for the radio portion of the show. The podcast element is about to begin. David Neuhuysse is Research Fellow in Philosophy and the Study of Religion at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. Our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield, we're at the end of the radio show. The podcast will continue now, and we'll hopefully see you next week.
On the theme of hope, David, what do you mean by it? Because there are some theological and even secular understandings of hope that are, if you like, a form of almost liberal meliorism. Namely, as we go, it's going to get better. Our institutions are going to chasten the worst things about us, and the path of ever-increasing progress will be great for us all, for technology, for the environment, for prosperity. And then there are forms, I think, of even a sort of debauched theological hope. That is, the hope exists already. It's frozen in time. What we need is sight beyond sight, in other words, faith, in order to see what that hope is and then gradually inch towards that. I would mean something very different by hope. I'm suspecting that Waleed might mean something very different by hope, but I also suspect that you mean something different when you say hope. What do you mean by it?
Yeah, so most directly, I think of hope as an ethical discipline that enables us to persist in the face of uncertainty. So I think of hope as being something that, by its nature, it's oriented towards an object that we don't know whether it's going to be realized. Hope has a sort of uncertainty built into it. But it also stretches out towards the thing. Thomas Aquinas talks about hope as being directed towards an arduous good. So hope has this sense of struggle and difficulty and uncertainty, but it keeps going in the face of that, which is, I think, as you suggested, it contrasts really starkly with the sort of modern myth of perpetual progress, sort of inevitably through the means of control and knowledge that science and technology gives us, that things will keep getting better. I think this crisis that we're experiencing now shows that was always a myth, that events can overtake us. And so we find ourselves thrown into this situation of vulnerability, which is where we were already. And it's in that context that I think the sort of hope that I'm interested in, the sort of hope that I'm committed to, allows us to say, we are vulnerable, and that's really difficult, but it doesn't have to crush us. We have the capacity to press forward, even when we don't know whether things will work out.
Yeah, and I think that's where the theological dimensions of this do come into their own, right, Scott? So the easiest way of dealing with the lack of control, the reality of vulnerability, is this idea or this understanding that just because you're not in control doesn't mean things are not in control, right? This is depending on which theological tradition you want to talk about, this is one of the functions that God has, is that God is in control of these things. There are wisdoms to these things. Now, those wisdoms may not be to your liking. They may not be to your temporary benefit. They may not be to your ease, but that doesn't mean that they're not there, right? And then that triggers a million arguments we can have, and maybe there's a whole other show, not even episode, a whole other show that can be done on that sort of stuff. But, you know, this is, I think, a way in which there is a theological resolution of the question of a lack of control. But I think that that's a really important thing for people to latch onto. The idea of progress as being part of the human condition, as though it's baked in. I mean, I don't mean to reveal my sort of conservative philosophical dispositions here, but it was never true. And it becomes really, really dangerous and really, really crushing to the soul at moments when you realize that it's not true, right? That's kind of what we're living through.
If I could just jump in. So I think this is an important question that you all are raising about whether theological language helps or hurts here. One way I think about it is that I think the problem that's posed by this myth of progress is theological in character. So some theorists have argued that the modern story of perpetual progress took a theological idea that was in Jewish and Christian traditions in some dimensions and it sort of secularized it. But if that's the case, then I think theological traditions can give us tools to provide a theological critique of that myth and to open up alternative ways of understanding our lives and our world, which don't necessarily require people to sort of have a conversion experience to take up. But I think the tools are available to anyone, regardless of their own convictions. It's one of the reasons why a lot of the theorists that I work on, like Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, they do the same thing. They recognize that there are these resources in ancient traditions that we can draw on. And I think it's especially important now. I've been thinking a lot about, so some theorists, political theorists, argue that the sort of characteristic experience of being a worker in a neoliberal capitalist economic system is precarity. Many people have contingent employment. They, under the best circumstances, they don't have a sort of long-term security. In a sense, all of us are thrown into that experience now because things aren't normal. It's not clear whether they ever will be normal again. The economic shock is going to be really deep. There's a kind of leveling. All of us, even those of us that are relatively comfortable, are thrown up against our precarity. But it's also the case that the people who are precarious to begin with are especially vulnerable. So it's not equal. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think this theological critique of optimism and complacency is especially important. Because some people, quite concretely, are going to suffer a lot because of this crisis.
Let me give voice to my concern here. And I mean, I know this is going to sound a lot like we're splitting hairs, and theological hairs, no less. Here's my concern. As soon as one says, we aren't in control, but that doesn't mean no one is in control or that there is not control, I don't think the only alternative to that is nihilism. I guess my concern is as soon as one evokes an alibi, there is quote-unquote control here. In other words, there is meaning that is discernible if one just had the right perspective to be able to witness it. I mean, this is one of the ideas, if you like, that underlies some of the late Jewish and early Christian apocalyptic traditions, that the world might look chaotic. It's not chaotic. You're just not seeing it with a wide enough lens. And that's why the angels then take the seers to various parts of the theological geography to show them how all of the structures of the world still uphold, all the pillars of the earth are still there. Everything really is working. You just didn't see it. I guess my concern is it's very difficult, it seems to me, for that not then to flip over into a kind of self-gratifying form of complacency. So to know that there is meaning here, I just don't know it, that I think can actually become a form of, if you like, bad faith transcendence that then allows us to turn our eyes away from the true forms of hope in the form of radical, imminent interdependence and mutual implication. So here's where, I mean...
That's a false dichotomy.
Look, I don't think it's a false dichotomy. I think it's an important distinction because, I mean, so much of what I've learned, I don't know if I've ever acknowledged this on air before, so much of what I've learned about moral theory comes from the Book of Job. And one of the fascinating things for me in the Book of Job, I'm with Susan Neiman on this, that philosophy begins with the Book of Job, not with Plato. That as soon as the friends of Job are more intent on discerning meaning and justifying God's control over the world and the moral nature of the universe, as soon as they do that, they have sinned egregiously by failing to simply sit in silence and care for the wounds of the imminent presence that was there in front of them. So I'm not saying, Waleed and David, I'm not saying that there's no meaning. I'm not even necessarily saying that there's no control. It'd be very strange to be an Aristotelian and not to believe in some kind of direction of things. I guess what I'm saying is we need to radicalize the moral sense that it is not for us to know. And as soon as we even flirt with the idea of knowing that there is meaning, that there is direction, that there is transcendence, then the worst of our propensity towards spiritual and moral blindness, I think, kicks in. And we fail to take radically seriously enough the moral demands of real immanence, namely that which is there before us.
That sounds to me like you're reestablishing the binary between meaning and nihilism. You can believe that there is purpose, there is meaning, but that it's not for you to know it or that it's unattainable to you. And all you can do is the best that the situation calls upon you to do. Right? You can believe that. But to critique the notion that meaning even exists in this situation means you necessarily have to tip into a kind of nihilism, which is fine. If that's the way you want to go, fine. I'm not saying people cannot go in that direction, but that's the direction you're going in.
I'll just say, and I'm keen to hear what David has to say to sort of set me right. I'm not denying meaning. I guess the posture that I'm trying to strike here is that of Sherlock Holmes, who says that the sun could revolve around the earth or the earth could revolve around the sun. It makes no difference to the work that we're being given to do. For me,
sure,
there could be meaning here. There could be no meaning here. Even talking about meaning here, I think, distracts us from the radical demands of real imminence and the immediacy of need.
All right. Last word to you, David.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the language of hope is useful, partly because I think it helps to find a way through this dichotomy between meaning and nihilism. So I think of hope as being strictly distinct from knowledge, and I think of meaning as being a different thing than certainty. That's one of the reasons why I think a negative theology is a useful point of reference, because it has this deep negativity built into it, but it doesn't slip into nihilism. Actually, what the effect of it is to sort of open up the proliferation of imagination and meaning. The denial, according to the 4th century theologian Gregory of Nyssa, that we can comprehend the divine, it doesn't mean that he stops talking about God, but he sort of opens up this proliferation of speech about God that's mirrored in his vision of the sort of eschatology of the final things, which involves a perpetual progress that's never complete because there's always more of God to be had. So I think that I've been thinking a lot about the creed. I have, you know, elderly friends. I talk to my grandparents, and I'm worried about them. So I've been thinking about the last line of the Nicene Creed, which Christians are around the world recite together. I look for the resurrection of the body and the life of the world to come. And I was struck today by the fact that that's not a claim of knowledge. It doesn't claim to be certain about what's going to happen. Christians say that they look for these things in hope, in my understanding. And what they look for isn't a sort of immortality of the soul that results in a sort of inevitable persistence of the human person, but it's the resurrection of the body, which is contingent and dependent upon the act of God. And it's not just a personal salvation that Christians affirm. It's the life of the world that comes. It's this idea that the entire world can be transformed. And I think that sometimes that eschatological hope that Christians hold can slip into a sort of knowledge, which is a form of meaning that I agree with Scott is dangerous. But I think through hope it's possible to embody this sort of middle way of pursuing meaning, of doing the best we can now, of not being crushed by the vulnerability that we all feel, while acknowledging that things are genuinely really ambiguous and really hard.
That probably best summarizes my position, but Scott and I will continue this argument off air, I think, because we're out of time to do it at the moment. David, thank you very much. These are really unbelievable times, and you need really clear minds, I think, to help guide you through it, and yours is definitely one of those. So thank you.
Thanks to you both.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.